This is Kenneth G. Costella, Associate Professor, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, interviewing Dr. Arthur N. Wilson at his home in Ketchikan. The date is November 19th, 1982. Turn that on. I guess, you know, what I'd like to start with is your background, your family.
All right, who was the John Hopkins doctor? Was that Gillespie?
Oh, I don't know who it was.
Oh.
I don't know.
1928.
I know, but these people that were there before I was there.
I know, but I thought maybe it was Gillespie, but I didn't think he was a Johns Hopkins.
No, he wasn't. I know that much. There's a girl who works up there. WLD.
Yes.
All right. Somewhere I picked up one of her stories, and she wrote her, and she wrote me. I knew her aunt and her uncle when they were up there. I think this is just one of the columns that she sent me. Have you seen any of her? She may not be there now.
I haven't seen him lately. I have seen her columns, Joanne Wolfe columns, before.
Her uncle, Osick Ward, had a finger in every pie there in McCarthy. He had a taxi company, had a dog team for the winter and a car for the summer, and he got you any place you wanted to go. He's a very interesting guy. I think the only dog team ride I ever had was with him.
Where were you born?
Well, I was born in India. My father was a Michael missionary in India, Presbyterian Church. And I was born in, say, called Mirage, M-I-R-A-J, which is 200 miles south of Bombay. Along with my sisters. The hospital there, where my father worked at that time, has become a very important medical center. It's called the Mirage, M-I-R-A-J, Medical Center, and has really a medical school and a great many patients. From that part of the country, there are people from Arabia even. Some of the wealthy ones that get down there. Of course, almost everybody who gets in there as a patient is has very little money.
Wait, we
were out there about 3 years ago to visit it, and we were a couple of years too late because my wife got sick as soon as we got up there, and all that heat and everything, she started wilting. You don't know what that heat out there is like
until
you walk into it.
Yeah, sure.
I thought I remembered, but I sure didn't.
What year were you born?
1898, in December.
And how long were you in India then?
Well, I was there in 1910.
So you really...
Yeah, I was there for 11 years. At that time, my father had typhoid fever, and then he got a pleurisy. And I don't know whether he ever had a positive sputum. I don't suppose that he did. But we did come back to Colorado and stay there for a couple of years. And my recollection is that he, although he did a great deal of resting, that he didn't actually have to go to bed and stay there, so he probably never had a positive sputum. So me and my mother went back eventually, and then they didn't come back to stay until 1925, when I was interning there in Chicago.
So after you moved to Colorado, did you go back to India with them?
No. I stayed there. We had our grandmother and some aunts there, and some family split up. Some of the children stayed there and went to college. So I went to Colorado College and Rose Medical School and the Cook County Hospital. And by that time, my father came back.
You went to Rush Medical School?
Yeah. Yeah, my father had been a Rush graduate, 1896, I think. So, I was in 1924.
And then you did an internship in Chicago?
Yeah, I stayed at Cook County. I got into Cook County and stayed there. And I was married right afterwards. My wife came down from Wisconsin to do some postgraduate work in social service, and wound up over at the Cook County Hospital. I'm one of her assignments, and that fixed that.
Was your internship was just a year?
Year and a half,
and then there was no equivalent of a residency or anything then, was there?
No, after that, I went up to Northern Minnesota for a year, up in the country, on the Canadian border. A place called Warroad, W-A-R-R-O-A-D. Warroad was right on the border.
Is that up by International Falls?
Well, it's between International Falls and Crookston. It's between the two.
Oh, okay.
And there it was 45 below all winter. And I got up to the interior of Alaska, where it was colder. I thought, gee whiz, pussy willows came out in April, Minnesota. I wonder when they'll come out up here. Oh, gosh.
So after the year in Minnesota, then, is that when you moved out to the West Coast?
Yeah, then I came out to the West Coast. Yeah.
And you were working for a logging company?
Well, I was working for a doctor in Seattle, but there was a lot of contract doctors, usually somebody would get a contract for all of the medical work of some big company and then hire people to fill it. So, this was over there on the Olympic Peninsula. Matter of fact, right, it's in a place right now that has blossomed out. Retirement homes and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's very expensive.
Is that around Squim?
And what?
Around Squim, is that where it is?
before you got there, this was called Port Ludlow.
Oh, yes.
All right. And the ferry would come from Edmonds to Port Ludlow? I believe so. I think it
sounds about right, Knight.
So, that's how I got to Alaska in 1930. I just had no idea of coming up here to live. But the price of copper was 17 cents a pound. And by December it had dropped 12 cents a pound. So the Kennecott people said, we're pretty near down at the bottom of this mine. We might as well close up for the price of copper level.
That was the Latouche mine.
Yeah. Latouche, so they closed Latouche. I think it was December of 1930. And they told me, now, the doctor up in Kennecott wants to go to Wrangell. Why don't you go to Kennecott? So I said, gee whiz, all right. So I rode the railroad up there to... And 2 years later, the price of copper was down to a nickel. Now Kennecott was an expensive plant to run because, first place, it was 200 miles from Cordova, all that long haul. There were lots of wear and tear and accidents to the tracks. Every year some part of the tracks would get covered over with snow slides or avalanches. And there was a bridge near Chetnaw. A bridge near Chetnaw that used to go out every year, a wooden bridge. The company said it really cost us less to put in a new bridge every year than to try to do anything with that. So that's the way that was. They had about 250 miners there when I was there. We had an 8-bed hospital, 3 nurses, a little X-ray with the overhead wires. You had to keep the alert any time you used the X-ray. Be sure no one ran into a wire, you know.
They were bare wires, were they?
Yeah. I didn't like those. We had a lot of fun there for a couple of years, even. You just had to make all your fun yourself. Once a week, you'd probably have a few people in for bridge. Other times, you'd either go calling or sit around and listen to radio. We did have good radio reception up there, so we could always get the news. There was a small school with 2 rooms. They would send up a movie about once a month, one of the old silent movies. There were always card games going on around camp. Now the miners in the lower camp where they broke up the ore. So those guys all went in for a card game called Pangingi.
Mm-hmm.
Do they play that up there still?
I'm familiar with it from, I was born and raised in Montana, and they play it there.
Okay. Well, they did. That was a big game down there. Now, up on the hill at the mine, they were all poker players. And believe me, that gang up there, as soon as payday came, they got their checks, the poker game started. When it was time to go to dinner, they'd leave their money and chips on the table and go and come back and start playing. And if anybody, any time they suspected that somebody was creasing a card, they would just throw that deck of cards over their shoulder like that. But if it was anything worse, if it was any infringement where they thought some guy really was trying to do some stealing, and I think a couple times while I was up there, some card sharp came up and went to work, but they didn't. They usually caught them about the first or second night, and they just opened the door of the bunkhouse and he's the guy right out. That's what it was about.
So the patient, you were seeing the miners had their families up there.
Yeah, they had their, down the north camp, they did. There was quite a crew of men who kept the sidewalks clean. Every morning they were out with their shovels, get all the snow off from the night before, so you could walk around, because gee, there were a lot of hills in there. Yeah, there were a number of families there. And these guys, they're all gamblers, of course. Most of them were playing the stock market. They would give the railroad agent there a dollar apiece, and he would get the reports. Oh, for $1 you could get report on U.S. Steel all through the month, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be 50 or 60 people, 50 or 60 names on there every day, and some of these guys would say, you listen to them, you know very well that this is no time to buy, but they were doing it. So hey, a lot of them lost money, and occasionally somebody would make some. They would gamble. The big thing that they gambled on was those tickets to the ice pool.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they usually went in pools. Usually, they'd pool up with some of their friends on that. I remember one guy who was an expert carver. He could whittle anything out of a good piece of wood. So I said, Leo, when's the ice going to go out? And he said, well, did I put on the day, the hour, and the minute that I was married? So the ice went out. I said, Leo, I thought you were going to win the ice pool. He said, Mrs. Wilson, if I'd put down the day, the hour, and the minute that I was divorced, I would have won it. Okay.
Were you the only physician there?
Oh, yeah, sure. Wasn't enough for two.
And that was what? So there must have been 500-600 people
total?
Yeah, there
were 500-600 people, yeah. Dr. Walkowski came over from Anchorage a couple of times. Did you ever meet him while he was alive?
No, I didn't.
Well, he was sure of a wonderful fellow. He'd been at Latouche ahead of me. He went on to Anchorage. He came over a couple of times, once when my older son had appendicitis, and the other time when my wife was sick, and helped me out, which was wonderful.
How would he fly?
Yeah, you'd there was one pilot particularly there in Cordova during that time who took care of almost everything in that vicinity. I don't remember who Wally, but I used to go with him over there at Anchorage. Harold Gillum, the one that was there when I was there at Kennicott, was Harold Gillum. And Harold eventually was killed down here during the war.
Hmm.
He was on a plane that crashed over here in that Boca de Quadra. Not found for much life. Well, they went found for a month, yeah. And there were about three of them that lived. There were three out of the five that they were taken out of there alive.
Well, were you doing surgery and all that there?
There wasn't very much surgery. They do an appendix or a hernia occasionally, you know, or somebody get hurt, a broken ankle. So there really wasn't, wasn't very much. But it seemed that there was about one baby a month, if I remember correctly. I was lucky as far as the nurses went. I always had three very good nurses around. The girls would go on shifts, and then if in time emergency came, why they'd dump up.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out all right. Well, the Kennicott closed down. They closed down in 1932. And in the fall, and I stayed up there and looked after them that winter, and the next spring I came on down here after listing around Seattle for a couple of months to see what there was there. So I got an office here in Ketchikan in October 1933 from Dr. John Beeson, B-E-S-O-N. Now, that Beeson's son is this Beeson who's written Beeson and McDermott. This is a medical of your wife. I'll tell you if you ask her. It's a medical book. Wonderful book. As well as there are certainly scholars. So this is our Dr. Beeson, who had been in Anchorage for a number of years on the Alaska Railroad. I think he went from there to Seattle to Ketchikan. I was here for about 7 years. And when I came along, I took his office and moved in.
Why did you settle here? You say you looked around Seattle and...
All right, it was 1933. Nobody, I didn't see anybody around Seattle that I knew who was making any money. Down there on 2nd Avenue every day, I would run into some of these men whom I'd known up in Kennicott, some of these electricians, plumbers, and what have you, yard men that I'd known up there. And Kenny Cotton, those guys hadn't had a job all summer. They were there from November to May, and Some friend would take them out, and I'd go along and see one of these guys I knew, you know, and stuff, and talk to him and give him more money to get a few meals. They wouldn't take any more than they absolutely needed. And so I, about that time, I walked into the Shaw Supply Company, which sold x-ray tubes and other surgical equipment to Alaska. And so I went in there and talked to them. They said, "Gosh, Doc," I said, "I think I'm about to decide I'm going back to Alaska. I think I'll go to Anchorage." And this guy said, "Well, look, you can if you want to, but here's an opening there in Ketchikan. Here's this doctor there who wants to leave. Why don't you go up and see? We've been in through there once a year. And I think you would pass up something if you don't stop and look at it." So I did. I stopped to look at it and see what it is. And I said, "Well, I'll let you know in a few days here." At least I was going to go up there to Juneau and take a look before I decided. I went up to Juneau, and here were a bunch of the Calicut workers up there who dropped off there to try to get jobs. They hadn't gotten any jobs. And besides that, all this was mad, I think. Rentals were very difficult for some reason. There just wasn't very much space.
In Juneau.
So I walked into Harry Race's drugstore. Yeah. Harry Race had a drugstore here, and he was putting in a drugstore there. I said, "Harry, you tell me about this." He said, "Wilson, go down there to Ketchikan. Dr. Beeson wants to leave. At least two doctors there. You're set with fishermen down there. And Ketchikan will pay their bills. Maybe don't make any money this winter. They might keep you waiting until next winter, but there's four kinds of fishermen, and at least two of them will have some money if the seiners don't let the halibut fishermen do, and go on down there." So, I mean, that's how I landed here.
And so when you took over Beeson's practice, there was you and one other physician?
There were two, Dr. R.B. Ellis and Dr. J.H. Mustard.
Three of you all together?
Yeah.
And how big was the community here then?
Well, it was about 3,000. These roads were all wooden, practically all wooden or gravel, very, very little cement. And you made lots of house calls. Lots of them. And worked out just like Harry Ray said. The fishermen were either worked at the canneries to put up the fish, or they trolled and brought their fish that they caught on a hook and line in and sold them, or the seiners came in with theirs. So some group, generally two groups, always could pay some bills. But the town here was took some time for it to recover, though. I remember that fall, the first one of these government relief agencies were started. It was called FERA, Federal Emergency Relief Act. And they had these women working downtown to look after the small babies, small children, so that the mothers could work. And some of these Norwegian women would say, well, we used to do that for nothing. We would look after all these the kids so that this mother could get a job. Now we're getting paid for it. They were quite surprised. But, it was several years before things were really going here. The one funniest thing that I remember, this was probably about 4 years later, there was a congressional...
So who was the delegate from Alaska?
Tony Diamond.
Okay, yeah.
Tony Diamond was there with a United States Senator and another congressman. They were having a meeting in which they wanted to bring out the fact that a couple of fishermen from here had gone back to Washington to see the president and try and get some relief for the trawlers. This had already happened. These two men had gone back there. The newspaper account said they didn't get to see the president, but they had tea with Mrs. Roosevelt. So I walked into this meeting just in time, and this is what I heard. They said to this, I think it was Mr. Ridley, who was one of the two. Well, Mr. Ridley, would you tell us what happened? And he said, we went back. We wanted to tell the president that the trawlers up here were hard up. But we didn't get to see the president, but we had tea with the old lady. I was just lucky enough to walk in and hear that because I bought the house door.
So was there a hospital here then?
Yeah.
How many?
There was a hospital here at that time. And all the details are in this.
Oh.
This thing here. The patients, the patients' rooms were decided by their sex. The second floor was all for women, whether it was women pay. Surgical cases, medical cases, where the OB were. The third floor was all for men, whether it was surgical cases or medical cases. Nobody would have dreamed of putting a man and his wife in the same room. In fact, I remember one of the stories that my partner told me was going out to make a house call where a man and the wife were both sick. They were all both in the same bed. The man said to him, "My wife has no faith in Dr. Ellis. This is why I called you to take care of her." The woman said her husband has no faith in Dr. Turner.
So they were in the same bed but with different doctors.
The same bed with different doctors. Oh, it is funny. Well, Doc, do you want something about these men, these doctors?
Sure.
Well, Dr. Ellis was a general surgeon who had been in Alaska a long time. He was around 45 years old at that time. He'd trained down in Portland. He had quite a lot of surgical ability, and was quite busy. Dr. Mustard, J.H. Mustard, was a entirely different sort of person. He was quite austere, sarcastic as he could be. He had a big following. Never did any studying. He would go up to his room and find unopened medical magazines piled on top of each other. He had been near the top of his class in medical school, but just never kept up.
Hmm. He was in general practice, was he?
Yeah, he was in general practice. I was going to say that most of his patients were alcoholics, but I don't know if there's any point in doing that. He was quite rigid. I remember one very funny episode in which he'd gotten on the Canadian Pacific ship to see a patient and hadn't gotten off in time. As the ship backed out into the channel, the skipper discovered the doctor was still on. He wasn't about to pay the Alaska Steamship Company an extra dockage to land Dr. Mustard. So they swung over the cargo sling for him and put him ashore in the cargo sling. And while they were doing it, the orchestra on the ship played Man on a Flying Trapeze. Back at that time, that was quite hilarious. I mean, that was some song as hilarious as some of the ones you hear now. And of course, the doctor was quite incensed.
Yeah, I imagine. Sounds like he would be from your description of him.
Oh, shoot. Well, Henry Turner, when I went to Kennecott, Dr. Henry Turner went from Kennecott to Wrangell. Now, Henry Turner was from the University of Virginia. He'd done his hospital work there at the Virginia Mason Hospital. Uh, He was a general practitioner and was very, very good. Had a lot of qualifications. He became a partner of mine. And we had, we hit it off in great shape. I don't think where Milo came in this. It was during this time that we decided to try and get an iron out and throat a specialist here, and had a letter from Dr. Milo Fritz, who was at Duke University, whereupon Dr. Turner went across the country to call on him and make arrangements for him to come up.
What year was that, do you remember?
Well, that was probably, I'm sure that was the winter of 1939, because he arrived here 39, 40, because he arrived here, he must arrive here in spring of 39, and was here for 16 months before he got called in the service. And he was in the service before Pearl Harbor in December. So this must, well, sometime in the winter there, I don't know, January, February, sometime in the winter. So Dr. Fritz was here. Now what else happened? How long been there? I guess that just preceding this, Dr. Dwight Kramer arrived in town from California, where he had done his work at USC. He stayed here in general practice from about 1936, 63, he died in 63, I remember, but he died in 64. About 28 years, maybe. During, I'll find that out for you. Just wait 1 minute. Dr. Donald Wentzler, W-E-N-T-Z-L-E-R, came up here 1950-51-52 and was associated with Dr. Kramer. Dr. Stagg, Dr. J.L. Stagg came here about 1937 or 38, and went into our practice. He developed a considerable skill in obstetrical work and had a large obstetrical practice up until about 1958. When he went east to be with his brother in Michigan.
So this was, by 1940, there were, what, a half a dozen physicians then in Ketchikan?
Yeah.
With Dr. Fritz's ENT and...
Yeah. At the time Milo Fritz was here, there was, Henry Turner and myself, Dr. Ellis. That must have died somewhere in there. Milo, Fritz, Dr. Ellis, Dr. Turner, Dr. Kramer, Dr. Stagg, myself. Yeah, I think you're right. Winsford was a little bit later. Yeah, he was a little later. Okay. When just before the war started, Dr. Fritz was called up to Anchorage, where he served in the Air Force at Fort Richardson. During the time that he had been in Ketchikan, he had done a considerable amount of eye, ear, nose, hand, throat surgery. The training at that time had been in all four branches instead of either an eye and for ear, nose, and throat.
I'm just curious, what kind of eye surgery was he doing? Or what procedures were done back then?
Oh, what was he doing? Corneal scars, and for one thing, cataracts.
He was removing cataracts?
Yes, yeah. Fritz is, this guy is ambidextrous. Boy, oh boy. He, we got him, of course, we got him everything he wanted. He wanted a set of instruments, and we got them for him, but he knew how to use them. He could pick them right in the order that he wanted, from the beginning of the operation to the end.
Was he actually a partner with you, or?
Yeah. He was for, well, it was, something in my mind seems to say 16 months. It was something like that. He came up with the idea of staying, but the war kept him closer, and finally he got his notice. But he was a hard worker. He didn't ever try to make it easier for himself. And just wonderful.
Well, were you still making lots of house calls during that time?
I thought I was, but I started making a lot more a little later.
Oh, you did, huh?
Because after he got, he got called up Fort Richardson, the war got started. And Henry Turner decided he was going down to Seattle, so he left here. Suddenly, summer, I don't know, either July, August, but suddenly there in the summer of 42, Dr. Ellis died. And then I really went to work because I had more surgical experience than anyone else. And so I really went to work. And I'll tell you, who was there here? There was, Kramer, Stagg, myself, Ralph Carr, I got work him in there. Four of us. And we really, we literally were in the office some every day. I know I'd never get through before 6 o'clock on Saturday, and I'd get on for 2-3 hours Sunday afternoon. Oh, God. And there were a lot of logging camps started over here to get cut spruce for the airplanes over west side of Prince of Wales and those parts. So I used to have to go over there at times on some of those emergencies. Well, let me get back there to Dr. Carr. You'll have to work him into the story. I think he must have gotten here about 1938 with the Public Health Service. He came from Johns Hopkins, the trained down there in New Orleans at the Public Health Service Hospital. Came up here as a Public Health Service physician, I think sometime after Dr. Ellis died, that his title got modified and he was allowed to do some private practice as well as public health work. So he was there from 1938 probably until 40 years, is that right? 37? 47? 57? 67? Well, just about, for about 40 years. All right, then, after the war, we had Dr. Louis Salazar, who had been with the Alaska Native Service since 1934. He's come up from Salazar, was a Cuban who trained in the East, came up here via Seattle and went into the Alaska Native Service, was around in several of the Native Service hospitals in the interior until 1945 when he arrived here. Now, I saw there was a good general surgeon. He's quite capable, and he carried his load, but had a lot of common sense. So he was there until, just a few years ago that he died. Well, what happened after?
Well, was there a big expansion of the population during World War II? Or at least the medical population, I gather.
I don't think it was. That came later. Let me pick up a couple of things.
Okay.
Here. Dr. Phyllis Smith, who trained in Colorado, arrived here in 1952 and was in general practice here for about 20 years. Also, in the early 1950s, Dr. Jack Clark a general practitioner from University of Indiana arrived here and had a general practice for a number of years. Now, you just asked me about when did we get the influx in doctors?
Well, and people. When did the influx of people occur?
Okay. Okay. The first real increase in people came along in 1950-51-52, at the time that the apartment buildings here were being built, and the pulp mill. There was all that building going on, and there were about 1,400 construction workers here. They had some mobile places set up for them. We got a couple more doctors, Phyllis Smith and Jack Clark, about that time, so we were kept up there. Now, some place I want to get in, what happened to the various epidemics, although that is in here. Maybe you ought to just take that out of
perhaps
out of that, or you can look it over tonight and see and ask me about it tomorrow if you want that. All right, 1952. Jim got here in 1960 after his doing his medical work at Portland and Chicago. He had his credentials for let me get that name correctly now. His credentials for his general surgery. And developed a large practice. He was joined 3 years later.
You'd like a cup of coffee?
Yeah, please, yes, I would.
Don't drink brim, do you? You're too young for that.
Oh, I can try anything.
You want a cup of coffee or brim?
Well, I think I'd better have prim this time. I had some coffee before. He was joined 3 years later by my son, Dr. Arthur N. Motion Jr., as an internist. About this time, the staff of the hospital became expanded as the public health service began to add members. Placing full-time physicians in Ketchikan.
These were to treat the native population primarily?
Yeah, they were started out that way. First of these, Dr. Bowman, B-A-U-M-A-N, was here in 1966. Dr. Yoder, 1967. Dr. Greg Gladys,